Why don't you sit?
Good problem. I mean,
how about the
lad? Yeah, just stick it here.
If we, that's if we
right.
do this and put the chairs
in,
just to create the presidium of.
Presidium, I think nothing.
Good.
So I've got two summer sheets, like, I've got some of them, and I've got one in 2 days later. And if my dissertation deadlines are moving, I have a take home exam the last 2 days.
It's already, but I always remember.
Some yeah.
I think it was 19.
Yeah. It's the second year. It's 2.5.
Oh, history exam is just 1 week for the
take home. It's like capped at 1,500 words per essay, two essays.
Ah, the short ones. We had 2,000. I guess
1,500 words. Well, I was just saying, they were Soviet uniforms. The army was wearing something which looked like semi-Tsarist uniforms. Already, but of course, the veterans were in Soviet uniform and they got the red flag. The Navy was marching under the flag of St. Andrew already. So I mean, it was this extraordinary mix. And then when they got to, because music is the emotional high point, so they couldn't play the old Soviet in those days. Nobody knew Yeltsin's little hit. So they played 1812. But of course, you know, the high point of 1812 is God Save the Tsar, which is taken out of the Soviet script.
Not my favourite.
That's where it really is. So, and of course, they played it Soviet style without God Save the Tsar. So, in a mad kind of way, they got a sort of hole within a hole within a hole. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm going to move my feet. I know what I'm thinking about.
Clean the space for a photo op.
Yes,
I know. Why are the masses?
Well,
they need to be enlightened.
Hang on.
But isn't there some kind of podcast or something? Is there, right?
There will be,
yeah.
I mean, that's why these photos.
It's your
photo. I think it was a Q&A, but about an hour and a half.
I have a class at 12, so forgive me if I run off.
It's all right, don't worry. I don't mind the side door.
No problem.
I fully understand.
So it's 11, and I think we should start, really.
You know. Oh, okay.
Let me be rigorous, rigid, and Russian, whatever. Judge me for it, but I think we have only 1 hour to proceed in the topic of tremendous importance. Okay, a little bit more. Okay, a little bit more. Let people come, but let me start by introducing my speaker. I'm Vladislav Zubok, professor of international history on the School of Economics, and it's a great pleasure and honor to introduce Professor Dominique Levin, whom everyone is supposed to know. Those of you who don't, just to remind you that he joined LSE way back when the Soviet Union existed, interestingly enough, and the Soviet Union still did not invade Afghanistan. And he became professor here, and he's a fellow of British Academy, has many honors and awards, but the most important of them, he was the head of our department for some time. He was also a senior research fellow at Trinity College, Cambridge, and remains an honorary fellow there. He also is linked to Japan in more than one way, and that gives, I think, Professor Levin the uniquely global perspective, both from Asia and from Europe. Needless to say, Professor Levin has a very unusual ancestry that gives him another important insight into the Russian mentality. He is the author of many books, last two books deal with a major confrontation between Russia and Europe, or some countries in Europe. One is Towards the Flame, Empire, War, and the End of Tsarist Russia. That was widely debated and received various prizes. And another, of course, is Russia Against Napoleon. I wouldn't go further, but let me just remind Professor Levin of a couple of episodes. One I was a witness to. We had a little seminar with participation of Russian scholars at the time in March 2014. And the discussion was whether Putin would take Crimea. And there was a heated discussion around the table with professionals. I think Timothy Snyder was there at the time. And nobody really thought that Putin would take Crimea. And I remember very clearly Professor Levin sitting like this and said, almost to himself, he will take it. And at the time I thought, well, then it's a turning point in history. Another point, is personal memory from working in the Hoover archives on my book, Collapse, The Fall of the Soviet Union, which is has been published last fall. And I looked through various immediate observations about the Soviet collapse, published around 1992, 93, and all of a sudden I found a text that really caught my attention because it was brilliant, it was insightful, it was informed, and let me tell you, it was an article by Dominic Levin. So without further ado, let me leave the floor for Dominic, and the topic is Empire, Russia, Autocracy, a Historian's View on the Ukrainian Crisis.
Thank you so much, Vlad. It's always nice to be reminded of the times when one made the right prediction instead of the many times one made the wrong one. Okay, I will do my utmost not to talk for more than 45 minutes, if I can, even less. Obviously, the thing to warn you in advance is that I am a historian of Imperial Russia. I am an international historian, and I am a historian, if you like, a comparative historian of empire. I am not an international relations specialist, and I am not a historian of even Soviet, let alone contemporary Russia. So you're going to get an odd view, which is fine, because it's good to have slightly different approaches. But just to warn you. Just in case, amidst my excitement talking about various empires and this and that, I don't make, you know, what is in a sense the main point very clearly. I think I should start off by saying that this invasion of Ukraine is immoral, it's illegal, and it is also damn stupid, even from Russian interests narrowly interpreted. Immoral because to justify the enormous suffering and the dangers of this war, which is a full-scale war, the absolute essential interests of the Russian people, immense life and death interests, would have had to be under threat, and they were not. To say that it is illegal is not necessarily to say very much. I'm afraid that great power relations are much more to do with power than legality. They always were, they are, and they always will be. Nevertheless, international law is not entirely irrelevant. It is, of course, not rooted in justice, but in prudence. And the ban on invading the sovereign territory and changing the borders of sovereign states is there for a good reason. Because unless you have that basic understanding, the future is chaos. If that is true in general, it is above all true after the collapse of the empire, when every conceivable border is disputable. And I thought that the speech made at the United Nations by the Kenyan ambassador was absolutely to the point. As to this not being in Russia's interests, you know, you go back to Talleyrand and his comment that worse than a crime, Napoleon's policy on the key issue has been a mistake. I can't even begin to list all the ways in which this is contrary to Russia's long-term interests. One obvious one is that a huge number of the most intelligent, able, forward-looking young Russians are going to emigrate, and many of those who don't emigrate are going to have their full potential wrecked. And in a sense, it is the potential of the younger generation, and particularly of its more intelligent and educated members, which is a country's biggest resource. Even if you interpret Russian interests in the most narrow, Putin-like realpolitik, this is nonsense, this invasion. I mean, essentially what they're trying to do is Finlandization. But to actually make Finlandization work, by which I'm talking about 1945 to 1901, you needed a world war, including two Soviet-Finnish wars. You need the Finns' ability to look at how lucky they were in comparison to the whole of the rest of the Eastern European Soviet bloc. And you also needed, you know, the sheer terror of the might of the Soviet Union. This simply doesn't apply in the present case. I do not think that Russia has the resources, even if it had an interest in trying to make 41 million Ukrainians agree to live in a Russian buffer state, is what it would come down to. And that is even before you get this extraordinary conundrum that Vladimir Putin talks of the Russians and Ukrainians being one people. Well, they weren't one people, even when, you know, before this war began. That doesn't mean that they were all united, but they were, you know, the Ukrainians have for some time now been a separate people. But of course, the one way to alienate that very, very large number of Ukrainians, particularly in eastern Ukraine, who felt themselves to be partly Russian and a bridge between the communities, and had an enormous affection for Russia, which they did feel as part of their own identity. Well, they don't now, because the best way to drive the whole of Ukraine east of Kiev into radical anti-Russian loyalties is, of course, to kill thousands of them and to devastate their cities. All right, I just thought I'd better make that clear before I started, otherwise, as I say, my enthusiasm for talking about Tang Dynasty China and Emperor Aurangzeb, it might disappear. Okay. One of the most striking things for a historian of Imperial Russia is to see the way in which Putin is repudiating Lenin and is actually, in his statements, falling back on what was essentially Tsarist ideological notions. You know, one people, the Russians and Ukrainians, for a start. Remember that, you know, Lenin and the early Bolsheviks saw Russian nationalism as their greatest enemy, and did recognize a separate Ukrainian nationality, gave it even notionally sovereign statehood, and gave it, again, notionally the right to secede from the USSR. And of course, those notional rights became very important under Gorbachev. Putin instead is the heir of the white counter-revolution, Russia one great and indivisible. And the white counter-revolution itself, and Putin, is the heir of the old Tsarist, almost core ideology, that the monarchy had succeeded in gathering the Russian land. Initially, the various branches of the old Grand Principality of Vladimir in the northeast, but ultimately all the Russian lands. And this process culminated in the 18th century, by which time all of Ukraine, save the old Austro-Hungarian, eastern Galicia, and all of Belarus were part of the Russian Empire. And, of course, it is to the point that in the old conception, you know, the three branches of the Russian people are the Great Russians, the Little Russians, Ukrainians in brackets, and the White Russians, the Belarusians. And these were all conceived as being separate, but very closely related branches of a single people. Now, it is important to note that until the last quarter of the 19th century, the overwhelming majority of the Ukrainian elite actually accepted that idea. They did see themselves as a branch of the Russian people. They were entirely, in most cases, loyal to the monarchy and to the empire, in which many of them made outstanding careers. And that didn't necessarily at all mean that they didn't have some sense of regional pride, local folklore, all of that. But, you know, that was how it was. As for the overwhelming majority of what we now call the Ukrainian people, like peasants in pre-modern times the world over, they had a very powerful local, you know, we are the people from here, our village, our little area. To the extent that they identified with a broader world outside their village, an immediate neighborhood. Again, just like peasants over much of the globe, their broader identity was religious. In other words, they were Eastern Slav Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, if you like. And they were also very often, to some extent, monarchists. The Tsar, the dynasty, being seen as some kind of symbolic, mythical source of justice and benevolence in a world which was brutally harsh and brutally exploitative. And the Tsar was conceived of as the protector of that religious community. Now, all this business has a certain sort of special, unimportant resonance, but it is, again, a slightly interesting line on this. As it touches on the Donbass, because the town which is now called Donetsk used to belong to my family. When my great-grandfather acquired it in the mid-19th century, it was an empty sheep run. He had some clear knowledge that beneath it there were rich coal seams. This turned into the core of the coal mining industry of the Russian Empire. The man who actually developed that industry, to whom we let them, was a Welshman called John Hughes. The workers, the miners, were in the great majority of cases Russians. But again, to be too black and white in defining who is a Russian and who is a Ukrainian along the borderlands of what is now Russia and Ukraine is a dangerous business. The local peasantry along much of that borderland spoke a peasant local dialect which was more or less incomprehensible to educated citizens of either St. Petersburg or Kiev. So that tells you something about the ambiguity of pre-modern empire and the difficulty of, you know, attempting to mine empire for modern national myths and identities. As for my great-grandfather, of course, he was not a Ukrainian, he was not a Russian, he was not a German. He had no sense, modern sense, of ethno-linguistic identity, nor any modern sense of citizenship. You know, you're dealing, again, with pre-modern empire. He was a cosmopolitan aristocrat, he was the Lord Chamberlain, he was the buddy of Alexander II, the emperor whom he'd known since childhood. One is dealing here with a different kind of empire to the one that is familiar to most people in the West. This is pre-modern, dynastic, aristocratic empire, as much as it is Russian empire. Read Andreas Kaplan, the best person on that, really, among modern scholars. Alexander II saw himself, of course, as emperor, but also as first gentleman of his empire. You know, to that idea of Russian Empire, of course, my great-grandfather was entirely loyal. He had, you might say, a certain self-interest in being so. There is a vast ethical, cultural chasm between that, the world of that elite at its innermost core, and, you know, Vladimir Putin and the present ruling, almost bunker by now, in Moscow. What they have in common, and not just in common with each other, but with imperial elites the world over, is a sense of pride, status, power, self-esteem, if you like, as rulers of empire. Rulers of empire, in other words, people whose lives and whose activities have a world historical significance. Really, that is in many ways at the heart of much of what it means to be an imperial elite. And although there are certainly rational, material interests involved in Russian policy, both in the last X years and indeed even in this invasion, one can find certain rational reasons why Russian policy has evolved towards this disaster. Nevertheless, it seems to me that actually the most important point is that one is dealing specifically with Vladimir Putin, but also in much broader elite circles, with the kind of rage and humiliation felt by an imperial elite. That's in my particular thing. Status, self-esteem, power. Now, like all empires by the second half of the 19th century, the Russian Empire is facing the challenge of modern ethno-linguistic, but also, if you like, democratic nationalism. The conception that popular sovereignty is the only legitimate form of sovereignty. The thing about this is that within the Russian Empire, the biggest single threat comes from Ukrainian nationalism. That is not because Ukrainian nationalism is stronger or more developed than Polish nationalism or many other nationalisms within the empire. It isn't. It's less developed in many cases. But it is because of the geopolitical importance of Ukraine to the Russian Empire. Basically, even in 1914, it isn't just that if Ukrainians, and therefore also Belarusians, are not Russian, as Tsarist ideology proclaims they are, if they're not, then only 44% of the empire is Russian. And that makes the Russian Empire acutely vulnerable. It puts it on the same kind of level as its much looked down on arch rivals, the Ottomans and the Habsburgs. So there is a very good reason why the monarchy attempts, to the extent it can, and to a greater extent than is the case with other nationalities, to deny the existence and repress the buds of Ukrainian nationalism. There is also a more down-to-earth point. Ukraine is, or the area of the present Ukrainian Republic, is the center of the Russian Empire's export agriculture. It is the center of its coal mining and metallurgical industries. Without Ukraine, Russia is not a great power in 1914. If Russia is not a great power, Germany dominates Europe. That is the 2 + 2 = 4 of European geopolitics. In 1917-18, because of the collapse of the Russian Empire, Ukraine emerged as, in principle, an independent state, but in practice, a German protectorate. That is to say, nothing rude or disparaging about either the Ukrainians or the Germans. It is simply that in 1918, Ukraine is too weak to defend itself against either its foreign, meaning above all the Russians and the Poles, or its domestic enemies being pro-Bolshevik elements, being Russian elements, being Jews, being all sorts of people. The most fundamental domestic weakness is, to go back to what I'd already said, that at that time, the great majority of the Ukrainian peasantry do not yet feel themselves to be Ukrainian. They don't yet have what we call the national consciousness. Again, nothing strange about that. That is true of most peasantries the world over, to varying degrees. It certainly does not mean that the Ukrainian state, set up in 1918, was somehow illegitimate. Given time, a Ukrainian government could have inculcated a sense of Ukrainian national identity into former peasants in just the same way that happened across the world. Certainly, Ukraine in 1918 is more of a nation in embryo, more viable as a nation than, let us say, the Iraqi protectorate, which the British set up after the First World War in order to control Mesopotamian oil. That is important to remember because we need to think in a global comparative context if we're going to understand what is going on, what has gone on, and what is likely to go on in the future. You know, we are still living not just in Europe, but also across much of the Middle East and in some cases elsewhere in the world, with this basic conundrum, the fall of empire and the legacy of the First World War. In the 1890s, the chief legal advisor to the Russian Imperial Foreign Ministry, a character called Theodore Martins, wrote that if the ethno-national principle triumphed in East Central Europe, which was dominated, of course, by four empires, the Russians, the Austrians, the Germans, and the Ottomans, the result would be all-out mayhem. And he was entirely correct. To turn the map of East Central Europe of 1914, a world of empire, into the map of 1945, which was ethno-national states, took two world wars, genocide, and not genocide in the kind of ridiculous way the word is used now, but full-scale extermination of an entire people, the Jews, partial extermination, but of the Armenians, massive ethnic cleansing on a scale which simply dwarfs anything we're yet seeing. And you have to remember again that we are still living with that in the Middle East. In many ways, we are still looking at the consequences of the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the very great difficulties in rooting the European model ethno-linguistic and citizen state in a region of the world where communities are hopelessly intermingled, identities were local, communal, religious Islam, dynastic to some extent in the old days too with the Ottomans. And we have to remember as well that most of the greatest states of contemporary Asia, by which I mean Iran, Indonesia, India, even to some extent China, are not empires, but they are much closer to empires in their composition than they are to the European model of the monoethnic state of citizens. If they catch the full force of European ethno-national disease, the planet's not going to survive the conflict. That will throw up. So again, there are broader issues here. On the whole, I think it is fair to say that the British Empire's decline and collapse was better managed than most in the 20th century. That, you know, is not saying that much. We are still living with the consequences of the collapse of the British Empire all the way from Ireland to Fiji. I won't disappear into a long discourse on the Northern Ireland problem, but it's relevant. So, of course, is the Palestinian issue, which is the direct legacy of the collapse of the British Empire. Most important of all is the Indian subcontinent. Not just the immediate horrendous consequences of the collapse of the British Empire, but about three, or was it four, wars between India and Pakistan, a confrontation which has now reached the nuclear level, and which combined with the impact of global warming is going to be enormously dangerous in this 21st century. And it is worth pointing out as well, and this is just one example I could go on forever, that the consequences of empire's collapse often take a generation to bear fruit. You know, when does Bangladesh become independent? Amidst very unpleasant civil war and international war, India-Pakistan, I think it's 24 years after the collapse of British India. Now, you know, if the situation is very fraught, even with the collapse of overseas empires. Certainly for the metropolitan people, the collapse of land empires is even more problematic. The British can, to some extent, forget the fact that frankly civil war has been going on in Burma ever since they got out of the place. Burma is a long way from Kent. Chechnya is not a long way from Russian territory. You can't escape all the inevitable battles over identities, borders, you name it, that always come up when an empire collapses. One way of thinking about this is terribly simple. In an empire, an old, the land empire, so I'm talking about not, of course, the British Empire, or most of the trans-oceanic modern West European empires, but in most empires in history, sovereignty belongs to the emperor. If the empire is sovereign, it doesn't really matter that much who the people are. Once the people are sovereign, then the arguments begin as to who the people are, and even more to the point, who they aren't. And at that point, you get really nice conflicts, particularly, of course, if sovereignty of the people is attached to democracy, in other words, the counting of numbers. At that point, it matters hugely just how many people define themselves as your nationality and not the nationality of your enemy on the other side of the forest. The obvious, though by no means the only parallel here, is Germany after 1918 and Russia after 1991. The basic point here is that in 1991, Russia was almost as much on its knees as Germany was in 1918-19, you know, at the Versailles Conference. The basic point is that the territorial settlement went against Russia in 1991 almost as clearly as it went against Germany in 1919. You know, almost overnight, 25 million Russians find themselves living outside the borders of the Russian state, the Russian Federation. Just think of the struggles caused by the attempts of French settlers in Algeria, the so-called Pieds Noirs, and the Ulster Protestants to stop being incorporated into independent Algeria, independent Ireland. 25 million Russians were suddenly dumped. Now, the great danger of a situation in which the most powerful community in the region, the most powerful country in the region, is also the great loser, is that, of course, when they recover their strength, they're likely to try and reverse the settlement. There is always an acute danger that will happen. And that is indeed what happened with Germany between the wars, and it is indeed, to some extent, what is happening now with Russia. Now, this is not to make the famous comparison between Hitler and Putin. Vladimir Putin is not, certainly never was, some kind of messianic character. I mean, he was a ruthless, cold calculator. Whether now, after, you know, increasing isolation, the illusions and arrogance which comes from 25 years in supreme power, never having opened a door for yourself, is changing him would be interesting to know. I have some ideas on this. This vast great book of mine, which is coming out in 2 months' time, one of the great themes is just what aging autocrats, the damage they can do. This is where you risk me going off about the Tang Dynasty and the Mughals, which isn't actually so funny, because they really did owe an enormous amount of the reason for their collapse to precisely aging autocrats. But I won't go into that now. The point you have to remember is that even without Hitler, there is a very strong chance that the German elites at some point would have challenged the Versailles order in East Central Europe. So again, one needs to, you know, make the comparison. The great point about Europe in the 1970s, 80s, was that empire was dead everywhere, except, of course, to some extent, in the Soviet Union. I mean, it depends on your definitions. But I do think of the Soviet Union as a sort of sui generis socialist version of empire, up to a point. I wrote a book. Now, I was absolutely unimportant, but from 1983 to the end of 1991, I was on Margaret Thatcher's little foreign policy advisory, 6 or 7. And for the only time in my life, except right now, I actually spent a great deal of time looking at contemporary, studying contemporary, as it was then, Soviet politics. I was, apart from anything else, LSE's point man on Soviet politics. But very interestingly, my title from my first appointment was lecturer and then professor in Russian government, never Soviet, which was rather interesting. But that's, and that wasn't me, I didn't insist on that, it was just the way it was. During those years, from 1988, early 88, and I'd been reading the articles I wrote then, I just sat there in bewilderment, wondering how the Soviet leadership, Gorbachev in particular, could be so naive. They brought back on the agenda the great questions of Russian history, probably the core problem, one of the core issues, in late imperial Russia, is how you manage to merge Russian authoritarian political traditions with Western influences, which have been flooding into Russia, of course, particularly since Peter the Great, even to some extent before. And suddenly the Soviet leadership, Gorbachev, opens up that Pandora's box without even really seeming to have any understanding of what they're up to. Ignorance about deeper Russian history, I think, you know, the ultimate cause, which was absolutely rooted, of course, in the Bolsheviks' claim that the world began in 1917. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to me extremely surprising that this vast security and military apparatus, which had suppressed ruthlessly all sorts of entirely innocent people half the time in the name of national security, would stand by and let not just the regime collapse, but their country disintegrate and be partitioned. Look, even the Indian Army, which has a strong tradition of staying out of politics, doesn't want to get involved in politics, absolutely loathe to get involved in wars against naturalites and this and that, you know, relatively minor counterinsurgencies. Even the Indian Army would not stand by if India itself looked as if it was about to disintegrate. The tanks would be on the streets. So it was astonishing that this ruthless, formidable police and military apparatus managed one pathetic coup in August 1991, which, you know, they weren't committed to, and watched their country disintegrate. It just seemed extraordinary. And what actually we are seeing now is that that apparatus is finally doing, in utterly ruthless ways, what to an extent it's most surprising it didn't do between 1989 and 1991. It is, if you like, a belated revenge for the collapse of the Soviet Union and all that meant to that security elite. You do have to remember that, looked at from the perspective of the West, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the evil empire, with barely a shot fired in its defense, followed by the recognition by the Russian new ruling elite that the ideological enemy in the Cold War had been right after all, and that capitalism and democracy were the way forward. That is just a fairy story. It is literally what, you know, Margaret Thatcher, if she had a really nice snooze in 1980 or something, this is what you would have woken up dreaming of, you know. I mean, unbelievable, unbelievable. But of course, if you're a Russian, it wasn't such a fairy story. You do have to remember that between 1988 and 2000, you were looking at what was a disaster for most Russians. You have the simultaneous disintegration of political institutions, the economy, and the country itself, to say 15 million Russians suddenly find themselves outside the empire, outside the Russian Federation. You know, you have life expectancy plummeting for Russian males. I won't go into this, but it is in a way, you know, as if you had something worse than the depression of the 1930s. You had simultaneously, I'm putting this in English terms, the collapse of the constitutional monarchy and the parliamentary system, the disintegration of the British Empire overnight at a time when most British people thought it was a fact of nature, and basically benevolent, plus the simultaneous secession of Scotland, Ukraine, and Belarus, Wales. Except it's worse for the Russians because no Englishman thinks that the Scots and the English are one people. They know they're not. Nor does any Englishman think that that English statehood, the monarchy, or English religion started in Scotland, because it didn't. But of course, the Russian monarchy did start in Kiev. And Russian Orthodoxy, to an extent, started within the territory of contemporary Ukraine. So it is, you know, a huge shock. And if Donald Trump gets elected by the American electorate on the slogan, Make America Great Again, with far less excuse in terms of American decline than the Russians faced, it is not at all surprising that very many Russians supported Putin, and very many still do. And as is always going to be the case, if the collapse of empire hit ordinary Russians often very hard in their pride and in their sense of identity, it hit the elites hardest. These are the beneficiaries of empire. These are the people who feel the decline of the state, it's the decline of its international status most strongly. And for Russian elites, you know, as I think said at the beginning, empire international status has always been enormously important as a part of their identity and self-esteem. And they are also aware of the fact that the Russian people have historically paid a vastly heavy price for that imperial status, etc., etc. Worst of all, from the point of view both of the population and the elite, is the secession of Ukraine. It was, as Vlad, I think, entirely rightly said in his book, I felt this at the time, Ukraine's secession from the Soviet Union in the autumn of 1991, which was the death knell for the Soviet Union. I won't go back about all the geopolitical reasons, or, as you might say, the spiritual reasons why Russians, and particularly the Russian elite, felt the loss of Ukraine so enormously. And if Ukraine in general was a loss, what Russians resented most was the loss of Crimea. For all sorts of reasons, but above all because the two great sieges in the Crimean War and the Second World War are absolutely central to Russian historical memory, etc., etc., etc. So over and above the geopolitical loss, they lost the base for their Black Sea Fleet. There's also this, there is a real blow to Russian identity and sense of food, etc., 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 and pride. And of course, the fact that Crimea had never been part of historical Ukraine to the extent to which you could talk about historical Ukraine, and was actually given as a sort of 300th anniversary present to Ukraine in 1954 by idiot Nikita Khrushchev, you know, that really rankles. Of course, it had no significance really in 1954. It's a sort of gesture. But again, it does come back to the fact that the Soviet elite lacks a deep sense of history. And that is one reason why, of course, many Russian nationalists hated that elite and resent it in retrospect now. I also think, these are of course all my own opinions, I felt at the time, so this is not just retrospectively, that the Ukraine, which emerged within its present borders in 1991, was only going to survive, or at least be stable, so long as East-West relationships were good and Ukraine could be a bridge between East and West. Once you get the collapse, decline and collapse of East-West relations, Ukraine is bound to be in trouble. Certainly, once the Ukrainian people is more or less forced to make even a geopolitical or economic choice, let alone a sort of existential choice of identity between Russia and the West, there is going to be trouble. This is not to deny at all the role of the Russian government in stirring up the trouble in the Donbass in the east. But it is an illusion to think that this is all just coming from Moscow. You know, there was a fundamental split. East-West is too simple, East Ukraine, West Ukraine. But it gets you sort of halfway there. One thing you've got to remember, you know, millions and millions and millions of Ukrainians died violently in the 20th century. This was a horrendous century of war, famine, terror, you know, and they were killed very often by fellow Ukrainians fighting on different sides. Historical memory is a time bomb. Historical symbols are a time bomb. And that is very difficult for a new nation state, which has to create those kinds of symbols. So there was a problem. And it was a problem which got worse as East-West relations deteriorated. And from the Russian perspective, as NATO spread east. Now, you know, NATO's eastward spread, if you're looking at things from the Russian perspective, it's the West selling you out, going back on promises, wink nudge made in the 1990s. It's an insult. Of course, if you're a Latvian or Estonian, of course you want to belong to NATO. Many of those people have a deep memory of their own awful traumas. In the 20th century and before, and many of them, I think, perfectly understandably, and in retrospect, perhaps rightly, understood just what challenges Russia was going to face, given its traditions and given objective realities, in making a transition to some kind of peace-loving, democratic, you know, post-imperial nation, etc., etc., etc. It nevertheless does seem to me that NATO's policy, you know, certainly vis-a-vis Ukraine between 2008 and 2014 was reckless. Above all, you know, waving the red rag of Ukrainian membership of NATO under the Russians' noses while actually refusing to take on responsibility to really let Ukraine in and defend it was obviously foolish. You know, obviously, if I've been going about this all the time, I am not saying that that excuses what has happened. It does not, for the reasons I stated at the beginning. But I do have some time, for Mearsheimer's argument about Western culpability. Sometime. You know, he is right, as I say, to argue that power, not law, is the true measure of relations between genuine great powers. He has some right to say that great powers want buffer zones and to point out that, after all, the Monroe Doctrine claims that the entire Western Hemisphere is an American you know, buffer zone in a way, despite the fact that, you know, the United States, by the standards of every other great power in history, has been uniquely free from real geopolitical challenges in its history. I think there's also an argument to be made. I don't by any means buy it all. But after all, you know, the American and Western British, too, invasion of Iraq in 2003 has some of the same marks as the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In other words, that it was, to some extent, an attempt by the Americans to assert hegemony, their hegemony in the Middle East, and to impose their settlement. Certainly, it was based in many ways on miscalculation, meaning weapons of mass destruction, and it has killed tens of thousands of people and destabilized a vast part of the world. On the other hand, I don't go as far as John. I don't. Firstly, because Saddam Hussein's regime was far more dangerous and had a proven record of aggression in a way which is completely untrue of the Ukrainian government. Secondly, because although they were wrong, I think both in intelligence circles in London and in Washington, they did genuinely believe that Saddam Hussein was building weapons of mass destruction. And thirdly, I'm afraid, for the very basic point, it's not that Europeans are any more valuable, one of us is not more valuable in the eyes of God or whatever than one poor wretched Iraqi or Syrian, but there are nuclear weapons in Europe. And any resort to mass invasion to change boundaries in Europe could bring on a third world war and come close to exterminating the human race. And that is not something you play around with. So, you know, it's that way I see the sort of balance. Final point, what about future scenarios? Well, your guess is as good as mine. I suspect that the Russian army will rebound from its initial failure as it did in the Finnish War in 1939 and will succeed in conquering, in inverted commas, probably the southern coast, Odessa, down to Transnistria. Probably, not certainly. I mean, there are all sorts of uncertainties. I suspect they won't go into Galicia, western Ukraine, because sending your infantry in to fight in the streets of Lviv is quite something. And they're going to be massively overextended anyway. But they can't win in the long run as long as the Ukrainians don't acknowledge victory. I mean, it is devastating to think what it's going to mean for the Ukrainian people, and terrifying to think what it may mean for all of us if what we have is a Ukrainian insurgency supplied over the Polish frontier by NATO. I mean, you are looking at the possibility of apocalyptic consequences if that happens. So, I mean, these, again, not things to, you know, take lightly. If I was going to say what would be my ideal sort of solution, not ideal, least bad solution, I would probably be killed for saying this, but I think that actually it is not in the interests of Ukraine to hang on to Crimea. So long as you hang on to Crimea, you've got a, you know, Trojan horse in your own country, and you will never have stable peace with the Russians. Even Navalny in his jail, he will denounce Putin's war at the top of his voice, and rightly. I doubt whether he will say loudly that Russia should give Crimea back, because most Russians don't think it, don't believe that. They think it should belong to them. As for the Donbas, I would do the Danish solution in 1919. In other words, referenda county by county. The basic principle being, as the Danes fully understand, you do not want people in your country who do not want to be there. You know, that would be my view. Now, that does not mean that the whole of Donetsk and Lugansk belong to Ukraine. No. Certainly it doesn't mean that ethnic cleansing in Mariupol should be rewarded. Never. But it does mean that if eastern Donetsk and eastern Lugansk vote to go back to Russia, my view, in the same way that it would be my view, Ukraine, if you know, Crimea is, we're better off without you. Now, I realise that that is an impossible thing to say to a Ukrainian people who are fighting with vast courage and patriotism. But I think in the long run, it is actually in their interest. For those, in inverted commas, concessions. Of course, they should get concessions on the other side. I don't think that neutrality as such is something that the Ukrainians need to fear. The basic point is, though, you can be neutral and armed like an armadillo for defensive purposes, and armed by whoever you choose to be armed by. I think that the territory of the Ukraine, which emerges at the end of the war, should be guaranteed by Russia and NATO. And I also think that Ukrainians, as a sovereign and independent people, have the absolute right to choose the European Union option. And actually, that is to recognise realities. If Crimea actually is never going to be Ukrainian again, whatever the theory or legality, it seems to me that Vladimir Putin has made absolutely certain that the great majority, even of Russian-speaking Ukrainians, are going to opt, in inverted commas, for Europe. You know, I would. You know, if my family had been killed and my city ravaged, you know, that would be my life. Standing back from it all, I suppose, amidst this utter awfulness, you know, some things come through as good. One, of course, is just the courage of these people. And to use an old-fashioned word, their patriotism. Another thing is the really wonderful behavior of the Poles, and of course of the Moldovans, the Romanians as well, but above all of the Poles. And the third thing, less emotional but more important, is the re-emergence of Germany as a great power. This is an awful thing to say, but one of the most shaking elements for me of this whole business is the constant refrain I hear on television, this is the 21st century, this is Europe. That reminds me of 1900. The self-confidence in progress, which comes from decades, generations of peace, prosperity, etc., is as false now as it was in 1900. Within a generation, you're in two world wars, Auschwitz and the Gulag. You know, you travel around Eastern Europe and look at that old architecture of 1900 and then, you know, Nouveau Steel, etc., and then remember what happened next. I fear that the next 50 years is going to be much more like the first 50 years of the 20th century than it is like anything that any of us have experienced. And it is worth remembering that in the last 5 years, we've had, firstly, a war with nature, the pandemic, and then a geopolitical war. But both of them are very small scale by what's coming up next. The climate crisis is vastly more challenging than the COVID pandemic. And in the long run, what is happening in East Asia with the rise of China is much more fundamental and dangerous than the present crisis with Russia. If Europe is to have any chance of dealing with the crisis on its eastern front and the even greater crisis which is going to emerge from Africa and across the Mediterranean, then Germany has to provide the lead. Germany has to be a true great power. And there I will stop. I should actually also probably add that I do not think that is in any sense contrary to Russian interests as intelligently conceived. I do think that Putin's policy of nudging up to China is more right than wrong. Having smashed itself to bits in conflict, firstly with the Germans and then the Anglo-Americans in the 20th century, the last thing on earth Russia can afford to be is in the front line of a Western Chinese confrontation, particularly since Washington politics are so totally undependable. But in order to avoid being totally dependent on China, Russia needs an alternative leg, and that is a European Union headed by Germany. Having probably annoyed literally everybody in this room and most of the rest of mankind, I probably shut there, except it was to make the obvious point. Ukraine was crucial. The Donbas was the key to European geopolitics, in 1914. In those days, you know, my family were the equivalent of sort of second-rank oil sheikhs. Anyone who tries to give me back the Donbass now, I'd change my name to Smith and emigrate to New Zealand. So again, we have to have that sort of sense, I'm afraid, amidst the horror and the human suffering of geopolitical reality. Thank you.
Thank you. At the start that it will be elucidating, lucid, and terrifying. Well, terrifying I didn't say. It is terrifying. But this warning to the young who never experienced major geopolitical catastrophes in their lifetime is a very timely warning, I should say. We've been lulled into all those nice IR theories about norms, shaming, and that stuff, you know. Not that they shouldn't exist, but reading them today. But by the way, shaming is not all that, you know.
Shaming's a good thing. Shaming's a good thing.
This drives sanctions, yeah. A wave of sanctions, yeah, against the aggressor country, yeah, Russia.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have tons of questions, but, you know, I want to cede to the audience, but I cannot resist one, at least. No, two. Well, I have seven, so two. One thing, do you think Putin and the Russians that still support him today, they will consider an unconditional surrender? Secondly, even with the maximum pain inflicted on by the West, the destruction of ruble, hyperinflation, I don't know what, you know, all calamities taken together, would it drive them into an unconditional surrender? And secondly, you mentioned a very, very interesting thing. I agree with you that Putin has a rationale. He's not a madman. His rationale must be immaterial, not material, although I value your story about the, you know, Donetsk and your family's possession there. But it is nothing next to the losses that Russia already incurred. So that immaterial thing of immense importance to us historians, What kind of literature he read in the bunker, you think, that turned him into Putin II, that not only betrayed Putin I, but Putin is, as a system of running the country, involved in global markets, involved in quite lucrative businesses with Europe and so on and so forth. And then, you know.
Yeah. Well, Vlad, I mean, this, you could imagine a situation easily arising in which the West does attempt to absolutely defeat Russia in this war and to impose unconditional surrender. And of course, if you're looking at things from a really hard-nosed perspective from Washington, given the fact that America faces a huge geopolitical challenge in China, some latter-day Kissinger might think that this is the moment to seize, to destroy the Russian present regime and to bring Russia back into the West's geopolitical orbit. And there are dangers about this, and of course it would also, to some extent, you know, sincerely and to some extent for its own political reasons, exploit the absolutely justified frenzy of the Ukrainian people and their desire for some version of justice, and the unwillingness of Poles and all the other people in Eastern Europe, you know, who have strong historical as well as present reasons for fearing Russia. So this attempt might be made. My fear is, firstly, that the price for the Ukrainian people would be utterly devastating in terms of a long... Look what's happened in Afghanistan, you know, being, you know, where a vast geopolitical battle happened. Not much fun. It would be very dangerous. I mean, it is when regimes face no exit, they have no golden bridge, that they can really get desperate. And I do not rule out, in those circumstances, the use of nuclear weapons in Europe. I do not. That may be just because I'm a gloomy old sod.
Not at all.
But look, at its most obvious, Hitler, obviously. But you don't need to get that far. Quite apart from else, the people who use them will be 50 meters deep in bunkers, and so will the people that they care for most in life, probably. And in any event, the game of chicken is terribly dangerous at moments like that. I also doubt, actually, whether you could force the Russian regime in that direction. You know, autocracy, that kind of system can take a huge amount of punishment and then roll on. You know, we see America only knows how many of these, you know, North Korea, Venice, all sorts, all over the place. It's a hell of a risk. So I actually think, much as I would like to see, you know, Vladimir Putin suffer for this disaster, you know, even if his regime is going to collapse from this, which if it goes on for a number of years, it might, of course. Frankly, you know, I'd much rather bite my lip and see him installed in a nice dacha near Beijing with his friend Xi Jinping than I would risk, God only knows how many people's lives, to try and bring him, or, you know, try and impose a really unconditional surrender. As for what he's been reading, well, Vlad, you and I know some of the funny things which have been written, you know, and I think he genuinely has, to some extent, signed up to this true sort of KGB version of the Tsarist, you know, nationalist myth. Of course, applied, it's not fair to, you know, Tsarist Russia lived 100 years ago in a time when their myths were similar to other imperial myths. But of course, they've lived on in a time now really re-emerged after 1991. And I suspect he has been reading too much of them. I mean, you know, from my own purely silly stand, I love seeing old Miratoritz's, you know, Alexander III statue back in Crimea. You know, I'd like to go and pat him on the nose. You know, this is the kind of thing I dreamt of in my time as a, you know, PhD student in the Soviet Union. But it's dangerous. It's dangerous. Not because Alexander himself was anything but an honourable, if in some ways misguided man, but the symbolism is dangerous. Sorry, a long-winded answer.
Okay, the floor is open. Please raise your hands.
Actually, I did not do international history. Mm-hmm. I do politics and IR, so I'm probably not completely familiar with this topic. But I just want to ask a question about your very last point made about the German leadership of EU.
Yeah.
And I actually want to know why it's Germany who should be on the lead. Why is it not other powerful states such as France? Because from my perspective, France might be more ambitious on this.
It's simply a question of power, frankly. I do not by any means mean that Germany should be some kind of, like Prussia in the old German Empire. No. Of course, Germany was balanced by the French and to a significant extent by the Spanish and the Italians. But for simple reasons of power, in terms of population, economic power, geographical position, Europe is meaningless as a great power unless Germany reemerges as probably the predominant. I mean, the great thing is that the German elites, to the extent that I know anything about them, are much more scared of having to take the lead than desiring to take it. I mean, they're longing to join with the French in a balance. One of the reasons why they were indignant at the English going was that was an additional balance. They're scared of power. They're scared of leadership. And given the utter mess they made of, in the first half of the 20th century, they have good reason to. But in the end, power is power, and Europe without Germany is. Of course, the great balance and the essential one is to somehow persuade all of Europe to balance the threats on the south and in the east. Longer term, as I've said, I mean, it's the problem of Africa, global warming, demography, migration, which is bigger than anything that happens in Eastern Europe unless we have a nuclear war.
I'm just wondering, but why out of all Russian Tsars did Putin kind of look up to Alexander III, given that, he was a ruler like after the turbulent 1860s and before the revolution? It just, to me, seems such a peculiar leader.
Not at all. It's absolutely logical. Because Putin, the imperial Russia, whose traditions Putin, has signed up, is of course that of the nationalist Slavophile, or even element, which Alexander III represented. He also represented a shift to some extent against liberal reform towards authoritarianism linked to nationalism. So he's the absolute logical person. In his own heart, and actually, this was sotto voce, obvious before now, Putin would have loved to have jumped from Alexander III to Stalin. Because he is a statist, he believes in the power of the state, and he is an enemy of democracy. I mean, one thing to note is that, of course, a vast number of Russians are also enemies of democracy, which they associate with chaos, weakness, and collapse. And actually, that is what most people in history also associated democracy with. It was only very recently that it's become, the dominant ideology. And, of course, it is, a perception of democracy which Russian history to some extent confirms. As the Tsarist regime weakened and liberalized, in the end you didn't get liberalism or democracy, you got the much harsher, firstly you got chaos, civil war, and then you got the much harsher regime of Lenin and, of course, then Stalin. And in just the same way, the 1990s and the chaos confirmed all the same kind of fear, about, pray God, the same dramatic consequences yet.
Yeah. Hello, my name is May. I want to ask you what you think Xi Jinping wants, and maybe implications in Taiwan. Forgive me if that's very IR. But.
No. Well, I mean, it's, I do live in East Asia half every year. So I was about to go off on a wonderful, by way. The book I've just written, I've been working on for years, as long as all my life, is a book about what it meant to be an emperor, from the ancient Middle East down to the 21st century. So I was going to take you back to the Song Dynasty and its obsession with getting back the so-called 16 counties, you know, the Northeast, and the way in which that obsession guided all of Song foreign policy and led them to disaster in the 1120s. I wonder whether Taiwan, you know, isn't something of the same. The point about those 16 counties for the Song was that they were seen as genuine Chinese territory. It's rather interesting that, you know, they're obsessed now about Taiwan. But after all, Russia pinched, is the only European power who pinched vast swathes of territory in the 1860s and still sits on it. I wonder whether that's because it is seen as dynastic Manchu rather than Chinese territory, you know, unlike Taiwan. So let's see. Well, it's terrifying. Of course, in principle, it's a much more serious potential war than the, you know, than the one in Ukraine, unless, you know, as I say, the war goes nuclear. And again, you come back to the basic point, you know, Donbass. In 1914, Ukraine was at the center of European geopolitics and Europe was at the center of the world. Neither of those things are true. You know, East Asia is vital. This is very major. Because after all, in principle, managing you know, a rising China, and it's perfectly legitimate demand to have, you know, an equal weight in the councils of the world, is a much bigger challenge than managing the rise of mostly Protestant, mostly bourgeois, partly liberal, fully European, capitalist Germany before 1914. You know, you were talking about the reverse of 300 years at least of Western and to a great extent of Anglo-American domination of the world. And that kind of fundamental shift in favor of a country which is totally alien to the Western tradition is a formidable challenge. Add on to that the fact that that challenge is going to come at a time when the climate crisis is putting the most enormous strain on governments and peoples. And you have the potential for, apocalypse. I can't tell you whether it's going to happen. It is extremely frightening. Extremely frightening.
So then I actually have two questions.
Yes.
And because I know no matter if this war is won by Putin or lost by him, we will soon face a transition from post-Cold War in Russia to post-Putin in Russia. And how do you envision the effect of this war on the transition of political or transition of power in Russia that will come no matter like in 5 years or even sooner? And also the second question is your view on the election of South Korea and will Korea be the source of conflict in Asia in the next few years? Because President-elect Yoon was kind of a conservative radical.
Look, on the second question, I'm sure you know far more than I do. I mean, I know the Japanese perspective. The closest I've come to the kind of questions you're talking about was when, somewhat to their mutual amazement, I was the only person in an American Korean, they have these annual, you know, 1 year in Korea, by some horrid mistake, they invited me along. Above all because the Japanese Prime Minister at the time had been talking a lot about East Asia and, you know, the rise of China in comparison to pre-1914, and I've written a lot on this. It's, you know, of course, from the Japanese perspective, unification of Korea is deeply frightening because they know damn well who will be the target for all the resentments that, you know, an unstable and newly united Korea is going to be. I would have thought, though, that it is the bigger danger, really, is Taiwan. The Chinese are not deliberately, and nor is anyone else deliberately, going to die for anything that the dictator of North Korea does, or the instability that the demise of his regime, you know, will bring. Talking about the demise, they will, for Taiwan, quite possibly. with, you know. The of course, talking about his demise takes you back to post-Putin. I mean, one of the reasons why Vladimir Putin has been taking these completely ridiculous, you know, to the degree he has, precautions against getting COVID is the wonderful old problem of all, you know, presidential autocracies, succession. I mean, this was difficult often in my world of hereditary monarchy. But of course, it's much more difficult, you know, in a presidential system. And since, like most autocrats of this sort, he has very carefully not groomed a successor, his entourage, I think, is genuinely terrified that if he did pop off, the knives would be out the next day. You know, never, I mean, I've met Putin, sat not too far away from him on a number of occasions. One of the things which always struck me was that totally unlike Western political leaders, who after 10 years in power look as if they've been run over by a bus. Putin looked younger every year I saw him. It really was. Things may be shifting a bit now, but you know, I wouldn't take it for granted he's going to pop off today or tomorrow. So to talk about a post-Putin succession is premature. One of the things, of course, is unlike Western politicians, you know, he can't go on the international lecture circuit and this and that, which he doesn't mean to, sort of billions nationally. But I don't, you know, I don't think at the moment that the succession really explains very much at all about what is going on in Russia, except for trying to keep him, you know, away from COVID. I suspect, but I can in no sense prove this, it's just a hunch, that in the way of aging leaders, he is very much thinking of his historical legacy. And that is one factor in his beginning to think in these long-term Russian, even Orthodox, you know, old perspectives of deeper and longer Russian history. But I might be wrong. I mean, I'm an expert on imperial Russia, not on what's going on.
Well, I suggest maybe two or three last questions.
Yes, thank you.
Yes,
so I know you mentioned earlier you can't make any predictions on what will happen in the future, but I was wondering if you could comment a bit on what Putin should have done before the invasion began. You mentioned Professor Mearsheimer.
Yeah.
I think in 2014 he had a lecture that where he predicted that there would be war with Ukraine somewhere down the line if NATO kept trying to expand in that region.
Yeah.
And in your presentation, you mentioned that, you know, Putin's main driving factors were immaterial ones of pride, status, self-esteem, and nationalism and revanchism from the military political apparatus. Do you think that there was another option for Putin to resist this salami slicing tactic from the West? Or do you think that, you know, war is a natural result of that salami slicing tactic, the eastward expansion of NATO?
I think it was certainly dangerous the way they did it. I mean, the Russians gritted their teeth, but they accepted Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. That is partly because they're geopolitically much less important than Ukraine traditionally, but it's also because every Russian always knew that the Latvians, Lithuanians, and Estonians were different people. You know, in fact, they took pride of it in the Soviet era. They talked about going off to Europe, by which they meant going to Riga or Vilnius. That is not true as regards Ukraine. And Putin is tapping into something, certainly in the older generation, which goes deep. This sense that, I mean, these people may be brothers, they may be cousins, but they're certainly not just any other foreign, you know, country. And I mean, that is going to be the big one of the casualties of this war. Look, faced with 2014, and I think genuinely foolish, I think you can't talk to, you certainly can't talk to senior British politicians in both cases nowadays, a few you can, but in the way that, you know, you could, because I had lunch with Douglas Hurd occasionally when I was in the Center for Policy Studies, and we could talk about history, about the history of the collapse of the British Empire and other empires, about Austria-Hungary. He knew what was going on. We can't talk to Western leaders really, in most cases now, about things like that. And therefore, their naivety also played a role in what happened in 2014. There is the bigger issue, you know, I think I said this before. If you're a Ukrainian, you know, my homeland is not your buffer state. I mean, you know, the West and Russia could sell